In our session last week, we looked at Joseph coming into Egypt, and he was met by this royal procession that Joseph had given him at Pharaoh's bequest, and Pharaoh wanted the family to immigrate there. There was obviously a famine in Canaan, as there was in Egypt, and it was appropriate that they come down there. And Joseph announced the arrival, and he told the family, he says, look, the Egyptians don't like shepherds. They don't even like us because we're Semites. We're Jewish Semites. Pharaoh was a Hyksos Semite, but he had taken over with the rest of the Hyksos people earlier and in a military coup. So they had control over the population militarily, and it was a queasy, if you will, at best, strength that they had, because they lost this a couple of generations later. The Hyksos weren't in control for very long. But this is one of the reasons why Pharaoh got along so well with Joseph, because they were both Semites in the same region. So Pharaoh was probably in Memphis, and the family was going to locate up into the eastern Nile Delta region of Memphis, where there was still some productivity of the land because it was closest to the Nile River. So there was still a little bit there, and they would be away from the general population. Now, Joseph says to them, don't tell them. When you talk to Pharaoh and you meet him, don't tell him you're shepherds, because it'll just not go over well. They don't like shepherds here. And so what the first thing they do when Pharaoh asks them what it is that they do for a living, they say, oh, we're shepherds, and we've been shepherds all our life. You know, I don't know that they intentionally did this, or they just did it out of fear of being in front of the highest ranking government official in the world at that time, in the world empire of Egypt. But Joseph said, look, you use the term cattle. Well, they didn't do that. Pharaoh obviously didn't seem to mind, though, because Pharaoh lets it go. And he says, you know, that I may even have some work for you. You know, you can maybe select one of your best guys here. I may have some work for you taking care of my cattle. And he says, Pharaoh says to them, you're going to have free and unlimited access to the best facilities in Goshen. So the Jews came in being treated very, very well. And then Jacob and Pharaoh come together. And you got to see this picture from God's point of view here. You've got Pharaoh being the highest ranking secular government official on the earth, and Jacob being his chosen servant to build the nation Israel, which will be one of the greatest, longest-lasting nations, even though it's small, on the face of this earth. And these two men are coming together. And the first thing that Jacob does is he blesses Pharaoh. And Pharaoh was blessed. Pharaoh was blessed. Joseph has rescued the family from the famine. And Pharaoh loves Joseph. And Pharaoh says to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? And he says, 130. But then he says, few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage. What he's actually saying is that they went by really quickly. Few meaning they went by really quickly. He's 130 years old, so it's not actually few in the terms of a number. And what he's meaning by evil here is that he's had a lot of troubles and calamities in his life. When he compares his life to Isaac and Abraham, he had a lot of problems. A lot of problems. Just think all the problems he had with his father-in-law, Laban. And he had to run away from Canaan because his brother wanted to kill him. He had a lot of problems in his life. And both Abraham and Isaac lived to be a lot older than Jacob. Jacob is going to end up living to 147. Abraham was 175. And Isaac, the longest living patriarch, was 180. The conversation ends with Pharaoh and Jacob goes up to Goshen to live and spends the rest of his life up there. And the text kind of implies that the Pharaoh and Jacob never got together again. So the family settles in Goshen, and it was the best spot for them. And they got property. They owned the property that was there. And the text in our Bibles calls this the land of Ramses, even though it wasn't the land of Ramses then, and Ramses was a pharaoh that came after this pharaoh. And we realize that this was also appearing in Exodus 1:11. So probably Moses, when he was compiling the various authors of this, put that in there. And to refer to the land for the people that he was writing to at that time. The district of Goshen is now the modern province of El Sharkia, and it's on the east side of the Nile towards Saudi Arabia. And it's still a very, very fertile area. If you ever seen the delta area of any large river, it's extremely fertile with all the silt and that flows down from the upper elevations of the river. Then, in what we looked at last week, the section that we looked at goes into a discussion about the famine and the different four stages of the famine, what happened during the famine, and that it's a biblical principle that we see here called the law of recurrence, where a concept will be stated, and then at a later time in future text, it will be elaborated on. We see this with the creation. We see this with Ezekiel 38 and 39 and some other places. So there's additional detail that's given here. And in this case, the first stage of the famine, all of the liquid resources were done. All the money was gone because the people used all the money to buy food. The food was not given to them. The food was sold to them. And some of the Jews actually were getting food. There were some others that came from other areas that were getting food as well. But Joseph, being really honest and real frugal and managing this process really, really well, didn't keep any of this for himself. He gave it all into the court treasuries of Pharaoh. But there wasn't any more money. It's important to look at Joseph's life and see that he followed God. He did what God wanted. He wasn't dishonest. He didn't keep anything for himself. He didn't skim anything. He provided for the needs of the population, and that was his goal. It wasn't to try and make money. It wasn't to get rich. It wasn't for Pharaoh to get rich or the government to get more powerful. It was to continue the life of the people that lived in that region. Now, in the second stages, when the money was gone, the people came to the government and they said, look, we don't have any more money. We don't have any more money. And Joseph knew how long the famine was going to last. He knew the rate of depletion because he'd watched it. He knew what he'd stored up in those first 7 years. And he was not going to resort to welfare. He was not going to resort to welfare. He basically told them they could trade their cattle for grain if they wanted to eat. So there's no abatement of this in the second year. And again, it's going to run for 7 years. And they bring the livestock in and they make that exchange. Finally, they offer themselves as bondservants and to sell their land to the government. Again, Joseph is not going to give welfare. He knew that if you give somebody something, it won't have the same value as if you work for it. If you work for something, you're going to be more careful with your resources than if it comes easy. You know, the saying, easy come, easy go, is very, very true. Joseph knew this, so he was giving them the food as they needed it and managing the process really well. He just had to ration it. They were going to be frugal with this because they were going to be getting it at a cost, starting with money, then with cattle, then with land, and now themselves, putting themselves into servitude. And they were going to be able to eat. And we haven't been in a famine. We don't know what that's like. But it's got to be just devastating to not have food and not be able to get it. They had one source, one source. They also asked for seed so that when things turned around, they could become sharecroppers. They would work the land, give 20% back in taxes to Pharaoh, and they would then be able to grow their own crops and live for themselves, which 20% was not a terrible tax for them because they were giving that 20% in the first 7 years before the famine, or the 7 years just preceding the famine. So Joseph accepts their offer and he implements it right away, and he buys all the land for the government and from Pharaoh, and then he moves all the people from the rural areas into the cities where the grain had been stored. He acquires all the property, and these people are now basically servants of the government, and they're sharecroppers. The priesthood, which was a government-sponsored institution, was exempt from this. They were given money. They didn't have to work for it. They were given crops. They didn't have to work for it. They were very, very powerful. And we know that the Potipharah, which was Joseph's father-in-law, Asenath's dad, was the priest of On, and that was the elite part of their society. And they weren't going to offend. The Hyksos Pharaoh was not going to offend that strong elite part of their society. So he exempted them from this whole thing. They didn't have to do the work. They didn't have to pay. They didn't have to put themselves into bondage. Pharaoh was going to provide for them. Now, in the last stage, the land transfer and the offer to lease it back and the sharecroppers was all achieved, and the 20% went into effect, and Joseph was able to keep everybody alive. They knew it was going to be a hardship, but they were going to stay alive. They could eat, they could live, and again, the priesthood was exempt from this 20% tax, as well as having to pay for any of the food. Now, Pharaoh was still realizing, the Pharaoh at the Exodus was still realizing the benefits of this blessing from Jacob, realizing the benefits of Joseph's planning and what he had put in place. Even though that Pharaoh didn't probably care about it or understand it, he inherited a situation, you know, a governmental structure that was in place with the taxation at 20% and the population being sharecroppers. He probably didn't know the history, but he inherited that. So the blessings were still in place at the beginning of the Exodus even, which is about 1444 B.C. For today's message, we're going to look at Jacob now living in Egypt and what happens to him as he's nearing his death. The text that we'll read starts from Genesis 47, verses 27 to 31. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they got them possessions therein and were fruitful and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life were 147 years, and the time drew near that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found favor in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But when I sleep with my fathers, thou shalt carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. And he said, Swear unto me. And he sware unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. Now, Genesis 47:27 clearly states that the Hebrews were doing well. They were flourishing there under Joseph's control. and living in that remote region where the rest of the population wasn't, if you will, because Joseph had placed them there and then placed the population back in the cities. So the Egyptians didn't have to mix with the Semites, didn't have to mix with the Jews, kept them away. They experienced growth in their possessions, in their food, and their families. Now, if we assume a modest 5% increase in their families over the 17 years, the family size grew from the 70 people it was to around 170 in those 17 years. Now, Jacob saw the effects of the famine for 2 years before he moved there, and then he had 5 more years to go through the famine, but they were flourishing nevertheless. He lives to be 147 years old. His demise is going to be told starting here all the way to the end of chapter 48. So we'll look at this in a couple sessions. And as I mentioned to you earlier, there is a tremendous amount of prophetic material that's going to be given, not today and in the next chapter, that I'll summarize after we go through it. Near the time he was about to die, he calls for Joseph. He doesn't call for anybody else. He doesn't call Reuben his oldest. He calls Joseph. And he says, I want to make an oath with you, a solemn oath. And this was more than a promise. This was a locked-in covenant. I want to make this oath with you. He didn't want to be buried in Egypt. That wasn't his home. He wanted to be buried in the home of his dad and his grandfather back in Canaan. And he knew that Joseph was loyal and Joseph would carry out this promise for him. And he knew because Joseph's loyalty had been established throughout his lifetime. He knew Joseph would do what he said. So he has this gesture that they were doing at the time where one would put his hand under the thigh of the other and they would make this oath. It's sort of like us shaking hands and saying, we have a deal, a very strong deal. Now, Israel was about to sleep with his fathers. And it's interesting is the Hebrew word for father and ancestor is the same. It's av. And meaning, what Jacob is saying here, I'm going to the other side. He knew that there was a conscious, alert, awake gathering to his ancestors on the other side. His body was going to be in the ground. It was going to be destroyed. But he himself, his spirit, was alive and would be more alive on the other side with this meeting where his family was. He wanted to be buried at the cave in Machpelah where his family was buried in Canaan. Now, Jacob was crippled up with old age. He could hardly move. He had cataracts. And he pulls himself up on the bed to support himself. And he makes this oath and he bows himself down as much as he can in assent to God for allowing all this to happen. Jacob's had a long journey throughout his life to put his 100% full trust in God. And we need to look at that and say, do it now. Do it now. Give yourself to God completely. Surrender to Him 100%. Don't hold anything back. And life will be easier. Life gets easier when we get on God's program. Because God's not going to get on our program. God's not going to listen to us and say, when we tell him, I want you to do this and I want you to do that. He's not a cosmic Santa Claus. We get on his program. We do his will. So Joseph is going to do what Jacob wants, and Jacob is comforted in knowing that. So the two part, and the text follows a subsequent meeting. Again, we're going to go through this chapter and a half here of Jacob's demise, but it's going to take place in segments. Genesis 48, verses 1 to 7 state, and it came to pass after these things that one said to Joseph, behold, thy father is sick, and he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told Jacob and said, Behold, thy son Joseph cometh unto thee. And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed. And Jacob said unto Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, and said unto me, Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and I will make of thee a company of peoples, and will give this land to thy seed for thee for an everlasting possession. And now thy two sons who were born unto thee in the land of Egypt before I came unto thee into Egypt are mine, Ephraim and Manasseh, even as Reuben and Simeon shall be mine. And thy issue that thou begettest after them shall be thine. They shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. And as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan in the way, when there was still some distance to come unto Ephratah. And I buried her there in the way to Ephratah. The same is Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is a city within the region of Ephratah. There's more than one Bethlehem in Canaan or Israel today, although there's only one now, but there was more than one. So some unnamed servant sees Jacob getting sicker and weaker and wanting to talk to Joseph. So he goes to get Joseph. Now, Jacob's 147 years old, and he's pretty much bedridden. And he knew he had so little time left, and he had some unfinished business that he wanted to deal with. And again, the next two chapters are going to go into this in great detail. Jacob is the only patriarch to die on foreign soil. The other two did not. They died in the land of Canaan and were buried there. And Jacob, as we just saw, didn't want to be buried in Egypt. He wanted to be taken back. We'll see that in the 50th chapter of Genesis when we finish up this book in a few weeks. So Joseph goes. He takes his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and they were somewhere between 18 and 20 years old at the time. And he approaches Jacob. And Jacob, I just get this picture. He's pulling himself up on the bed because he's all crippled up from old age. He's got cataracts. He can barely see. And he starts relating his experience with God and a discussion of the covenant that was originally given to Abraham that was passed to Isaac, his dad, and then to himself. And God made personal appearances to each one of these patriarchs. He starts by recalling the very first time that God appeared to him in Bethel in the land of Canaan. Now, Bethel and Luz are interchangeable terms. It's the same name. Jacob is also now designating Joseph as his firstborn heir. He's not the firstborn, but he becomes the heir with firstborn rights. Remember what happened to Judah and Simeon and Reuben, and they all sinned greatly. They were removed from their status as having a higher position in terms of the inheritance. Joseph is now getting it. And he, as the firstborn heir, is going to get a double portion of the blessing. I don't think Joseph could have cared for the material possessions that were going to come, even though they were very, very wealthy, extremely wealthy. Joseph is the second in command of the greatest nation in the world at that time. And I think he had more than he could ever care for. But the as heir of the covenant was really, really important. So he's getting a double portion. Jacob restates the essential components of the covenant. He says, God blessed me and said unto me, Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and I will make of thee a company of peoples, and will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. In other words, the first promise is, I'm going to give you a household filled with people and things. I'm going to bless you. And second, I'm going to multiply you. It was a national blessing for the Hebrews. changed his name to Israel. The nation Israel came from Jacob. And third, a promise was to make him a company of peoples. That's the 12 tribes that came from Jacob. And fourth, the promise of the land as an everlasting possession. An everlasting possession, the land of Canaan. So he's reconfirming the Abrahamic covenant that was given to him, a land, seed, and a blessings. And following this reconfirmation in front of Joseph, he then officially adopts his two kids. They're mine. He says, they're mine. I'm sure Joseph was really surprised by this. But Jacob incorporates these two kids into his descendants. They become part of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now you look at that and you think, my goodness, if Joseph, there's already 12 and then this is 14. What the Bible does is it takes Joseph out, puts these two in, so that makes 13. And then as we move through the scriptures, they will remove one at different times for different purposes and change their order depending upon what God is saying and doing at that particular time. And I'll get into that in a little more detail next week. So these two were technically born in Egypt, and Jacob had to make them his own children in order to have a legal adoption and allow them to be heirs that would receive this covenant. Not just the money. It's this covenant that was so important. Because that covenant has got them back in the land today. That covenant is what is going to get them a future. It has preserved them. Since antiquity, these people have been a unique people. You know, the Jews are the barometer of Bible prophecy. We're seeing the seeds of this in Genesis, and we've seen, those of us, those of you with me when we did the Revelation, you can see how that pans out in the Revelation. So, here's Jacob making a formal declaration to adopt them, and he wants them to have an equal share, because what he's saying is here, thy two sons, who were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came unto thee into Egypt, are mine. Ephraim, Manasseh, even as Reuben and Simeon shall be mine. Now, Ephraim and Manasseh are going to replace Reuben and Simeon in the birth order. I mean, Reuben and Simeon are still his kids, but in terms of the birth order, and this is like keeping score here and seeing who's on first. Because as I said, this is going to change. Joseph goes up to the top, but in the form of Ephraim and Manasseh. And you can see this in 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 to 2, that says, while Judah has the preeminence, meaning the Lord Jesus, the Messiah, came through the line of Judah. And we'll look at that when we get to the next chapter. Joseph had the birthright, and this adoption made these two kids legal heirs to the covenant. Again, he says, thy issue that thou begettest after them. He's going now into the other kids that Joseph had or will have shall be thine. In other words, they're not mine, they're yours. I'm only taking Ephraim and Manasseh. They shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. Meaning they're going to get something, they're going to be included, but not in the covenanted line. Not in that precious covenant. They're not mentioned anywhere, but their descendants are included in the families of Ephraim and Manasseh. And they're mentioned in Numbers 26 and in 1 Chronicles 7. Joseph was now placed into the position of firstborn, but through his two sons. And Joseph's mother, Rachel, was also honored here in this last will and testimony, if you will, this prophecy that Jacob was given. She died by his side on his return from Paddan Aram. And But she never saw Joseph grow. She didn't see Joseph get stolen, and she didn't see him become the viceroy of the greatest nation in the world at that time. And he became the savior of Israel. Jacob was honoring her, too, with this as he makes this statement to her as she died in Bethlehem. Jacob is now going to bless Ephraim and Manasseh, and this has got significant prophetic importance, too. I'm just going to touch on it this morning, but in our next two sessions, we'll go into it in a lot more detail of how this blessing actually was manifested. The text reads in Genesis 48, verses 8 to 21, "And Israel beheld Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are these?' And Joseph said unto his father, 'They are my sons, whom God hath given me here.' And he said, 'Bring them, I pray thee, unto me, and I will bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see. And he brought them near unto him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said unto Joseph, 'I had not thought to see thy face, and, lo, God hath let me see thy seed also.' And Joseph brought them out from between his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them near unto him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly. For Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, 'The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God who hath fed me all my life long unto this day, the angel who hath redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow unto a multitude in the midst of the earth.' When Joseph saw that his father has laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. And he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, 'Not so, my father. This is the firstborn. Put thy right hand upon his head.' And his father refused and said, 'I know it, son. I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Howbeit his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations.' And he blessed them that day, saying, 'In thee will Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim and as Manasseh.' And he set Ephraim before Manasseh." Got to picture this. Joseph is bringing his kids into Jacob. Jacob can hardly see because his eyes are so covered over with cataracts. And he's not asking who these kids are because he's asked for them. He knows who they are, but he just wants to make sure, you know, bring them a little closer so I can see them. Bring them near. And he kisses them and embraces them. And he's got every intention of blessing these kids through his cataracts, if you will. And he never thought he would see Joseph again. And it's been about 59 years now since. It's been a long, long, long time. And here he is at the end of his life. And he's just looking at this and saying, man, I never thought I'd see you again. Now I'm seeing your kids and everything that's happened here. And, he's just looking back on his life and seeing how God has directed him where he would have him go. And isn't that true with our lives? We can look back and we can see every juncture where God has moved us in a particular way, set our circumstances differently, blessed us in ways, corrected us in other ways to get us to follow his will. But he's adopting these kids and he's giving them an inheritance. So Joseph, as he's releasing his two sons to go over to Jacob, he bows himself to the ground as low as he can with his head down on the ground, signifying his submission to his father, the family patriarch. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and he brought them near unto him. Now, just picture this. Somebody's facing me, and my right hand is going to touch that person's left hand, and my left hand is going to touch that person's right hand. So he pushes these two kids towards Jacob. Manasseh would be on Jacob's right hand because he was the firstborn to receive the normal blessing of the firstborn. Then unexpectedly, Jacob crisscrosses his hands. You know, Joseph is just, hey, wait a minute. You know, he's thinking, well, you know, dad's, he's getting old. He is old. He's 147. And I'm sure he can't see well, so he's just got this messed up here. Jacob knew exactly what he was doing. This was not happenstance, because the text says that he placed his hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly. He knew exactly what he was doing. He just had to get the kids in close proximity to him so he could see through the cataracts and identify them to make the blessing that he wanted to do. He proceeds to conduct this blessing, and it is Joseph that is being blessed, but the blessing is going through Joseph to these two kids, because they were going to be independent tribes, and they would have their own region in the nation Israel when they went in after the Exodus, finally, under General Joshua. When they went in and they established these different geographic regions, Joseph didn't have one. He had two, Manasseh and Ephraim. So Jacob is focusing on this covenant and saying, God has guided me my entire life. I'm like a sheep, you know, and I didn't know it. And God is just moving me exactly where he wants to in a loving manner my entire life. Even though he had a lot of adversarial experiences, God preserved him through them all. And he does the same thing to us. If you are a child of the living God, he will preserve you. You may have a rough time periodically, but it's for your own good. For your own good. He even mentions the angel of Jehovah, the one that wrestled with him all night, to signify that your life is going to be tough. The life of your people is going to be tough, but God is going to be with you. God is going to be with you. And that was when his name was changed to Israel. Remember when he was by the Jabbok River? Just before he went to meet with Esau, God changed his name to Israel. And he says, let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude on the midst of the earth. And with that, the blessing was complete. Joseph is looking at this and sees the end of the blessing and the hands being crisscrossed, and he gets a little irritated with this, and he says, well, wait a minute. This is a real serious thing that's going on here. This blessing is just huge, because they all know God's providential nature with the nation Israel and what he has done. And so Joseph sees this and he tries to correct it. And he tries to hold up his father's hand and take it off of Ephraim's head and put it on Manasseh's. And Jacob says, no, I mean to do this. I mean to do this. This is not a mistake. He intended it that way. Ephraim, the youngest, would have the firstborn benefits. Ephraim, the youngest, would have the firstborn benefits. And in doing so, he says, the younger brother shall be greater than he, and his son shall become, his seed shall become a multitude of the nations. Now, Ephraim did become the most dominant of all the 12 tribes, all of them. Ephraim had, at times, lower and higher population numbers than Manasseh. Most of the time, the population numbers were lower. But in the census, when they're listing these tribes, Ephraim is listed higher than Manasseh. And in the order of the tribal chiefs that are listed a couple of times in Numbers, Ephraim is higher than Manasseh. The name Ephraim is frequently used throughout the Old Testament to refer to the entire nation of Israel, not always just referring to a particular person or the tribe that came from him or the geographic region in the northern part of Israel. It refers specifically to the entire nation of Israel. And I put some references down there for you to look at. Manasseh was more numerous than Ephraim just before the conquest of Canaan, and that was about 1400 B.C. The Exodus was about 1444 B.C., and then they wandered for 40 years. So it was around 1440 B.C. that Joshua went in to Canaan and conquered Canaan and set up the various geographic regions for the tribes. Manasseh didn't compare with Ephraim in terms of wealth, power, and even population in some of the later years. Manasseh got two separate regions. It was broken in half. It's one region, but it was broken in half. I'll put a map in next week to show you how the regions were broken up. Western Manasseh never completely expelled the natives. They were supposed to conquer the area, and they were supposed to get rid of all the Canaanites. The Canaanites were very, very sick people, spiritually sick, physically sick, disease-ridden with sexually transmitted disease, drug-infested and idolaters, and they were supposed to be all limited. Well, it didn't happen in some of the areas, and Western Manasseh was one of them. He set Ephraim before Manasseh. That's what we need to remember. Ephraim gets set before Manasseh. And the last two verses of Genesis 48 discuss a return to the land. And Israel said unto Joseph, before I die, but God will be with you and bring you again into the land of your fathers. Moreover, I've given to thee one portion above thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with the sword and with my bow. So as Jacob is near the end of his life, he's saying that Joseph, you're going to go back to Israel. You're going to go back to the country, and so will your descendants. And the Jews are going to go back in the Exodus. But it's going to be 400 years. Joseph's bones are going to go back. Moses is going to carry those bones out during the Exodus, and they're going to bury him back in Israel. Jacob references the extra portion that Joseph got as the preeminent heir, in terms of the covenant, not the line through whom the Messiah would come. And he does that through these two sons. And the land that he's given, very specifically, it's not just all the land, but he's given to Joseph the land of Shechem. He says, we took it with the sword. And we remember the incident of Dinah, where Dinah got raped. And Simeon goes back with one of his brothers, I think it was Levi, and they just kill everybody in Shechem after they had them circumcised under the guise of, you know, we'll be your buddies, we'll merge with you and have this country with you. And that wasn't what happened. But they took it. They took the land. Now, Jacob had also bought some property there and built a house. So he had ownership of part of the property, but the rest of it he took by the sword during the time that he was there. This is also the place within Manasseh's territory where Joseph was going to be buried, in Shechem. You get into Joshua, the end of the book of Joshua, 24:32, and the text says, and the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in the parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money. and they became the inheritance of the children of Joseph. Amen.